Washington Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session. The Honorable Mary Becker presiding.
First case this morning is State versus Phillips. Are the parties ready?
Yes.
All right, please proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Sarah Robsky on behalf of Mr. Phillips. I would like to reserve 2 minutes. Yes. We're asking this court to reverse or to find that RCW 994A836 is unconstitutionally void and it violated Mr. Phillips' equal protection rights in this case, and ask that this exceptional sentence be reversed and remanded for sentencing with the standard range, in his case 120 to 160 months. Under the vagueness challenge, the special allegation is vague in all its applications under the second part of the vagueness analysis, in that the statute provides no guidelines to protect against arbitrary, ad hoc, or discriminatory filing. In Johnson versus United States, the recent U.S. Supreme Court case that discussed the vagueness doctrine found that even if some conduct falls within the purview of the statute, that does not necessarily save it from a vagueness challenge, and that if the court finds that a statute to be vague, it is necessarily vague in all of its applications.
What exactly are you using Johnson to support? Are you suggesting that Johnson represents a change in the law that has been applied for decades in terms of deciding whether something is void for vagueness?
No, I'm not. I'm just that it's a most recent declaration by the Supreme Court talking about the vagueness doctrine.
Is there some reason why we would cite or discuss or think about the Johnson case, or is it just that it's the most recent pronouncement?
It's just that, but it just came out.
No other reason for us to read that case.
No, and
you're
it's
not
long.
Saying that it's like that case.
No. I'm just saying it's a recent pronouncement on vagueness doctrine. But following Rice, where the state Supreme Court ruled that in this statute, shall actually means may, that opened the doors to an inordinate amount of subjective interpretation on part of the prosecutor on when to file it. And
how is that so? I mean, isn't may kind of what shall always means in a statute that tells a prosecutor what to do? Because prosecutors do have, they may or may not charge in just about any case that there is. They have a tremendous amount of discretion. They may or may not charge somebody who commits a serious crime or not serious crime, any crime.
That's true, but there have to be. It's not limitless. Their discretion is not limitless.
Yes, it is, isn't it? I mean, in the sense of whether they charge or not. I mean, if a prosecutor decides not to charge a robbery, let's say, the court doesn't come over to the prosecutor's office and say, you shall charge that case. Isn't that true?
That's true. Right. The court will not do that. But I do think that there are limits. I would submit that there are limits on the prosecutorial discretion. It can't be just simply, well, today we're deciding to charge people who wear blue who have committed robbery with...
Well, wouldn't it be fair to say the prosecutor has absolute discretion so long as the discretion isn't used for an illegal or unconstitutional purpose?
Yes, and I would say in this case...
Okay, what's the illegal or constitutional purpose demonstrated by the record in this case?
The unconstitutional purpose is that in this case, he was charged with a mandatory minimum or sentenced to a mandatory minimum of 300 months, and people who are similarly situated simply aren't getting that sort of sentence.
Which people are these?
These are unpublished cases out of this court last year, State versus Carr. A defendant was convicted of child molestation in the first... Agree.
You're going to tell us those are cases with the same crime, but are the facts comparable? And how do we know that they're comparable?
In this case, he was charged with child molestation in the first degree by inappropriately touching an 8-year-old girl, oddly enough, at a thrift store.
So nothing wrong
with
that. He
got 68 months.
You're just saying that the prosecutor shouldn't have alleged that it was a predatory offense.
There are no standards for when they do it or when they don't. If this case, this person got 68 months for doing essentially the same thing versus a mandatory sentence of 300 months.
Well, okay, but what he got is a function of the prosecutor's decision to charge, right? So what you're attacking the charge.
I'm attacking
You're saying that the charging the special allegation for sentencing purposes and submitting it to the jury was wrong because the statute is unconstitutionally vague as to when child molestation is predatory as opposed to merely child molestation.
Correct. It seems completely ad hoc in this circumstance where someone who does essentially the same thing gets...
How is that demonstrated by the fact that there may be... There certainly are. I mean, you probably don't have to look at unpublished opinions to find child molestation cases in published opinions where there was no charge of predatory offense. So that certainly happens. Sometimes child molestation, most of the time it seems, is not charged as a... there's no special allegation of predatory. So now I'm trying to zero in on what your real argument is here. You're saying that if his child molestation can be a predatory offense that adds 300 months or whatever it is, then all child molestations, why not? They're all predatory. Is that your argument?
Essentially, or why any of them? I mean, you have to defend it behind and in front of me, and I know defendants would like that.
Different counties in this state have different plea bargain policies. Some prosecutors claim to be tough on crime and won't reduce certain crimes to go to trial instead. Others prefer not to go to trial and reduce the same crimes regularly as a matter of policy. Is that unconstitutional?
I think it is at least problematic where you have people committing the exact same offense or very, very similar offenses,
a case where different charging and prosecuting policies between different local jurisdictions have been found to violate a defendant's constitutional rights?
No, I'm not aware of that. I am aware that there is discussion about it in the death penalty situation where, depending on geographically what prosecutor you have a much higher chance of getting it. And that's been discussed as problematic, but I don't believe it's been found to be unconstitutional.
Let me direct your attention to the definition of predatory. I mean, it seems to me the heart of the case is whether or not this definition provides sufficient guidance to prosecutors, and it seems to me to be a very detailed definition that the legislature has set forth here, and that it fits the facts of this case. So, I mean, you know, your discussion of Rice and Shell versus May, I don't see how that fits into your argument at all. It seems to me that if you're going to argue that this is vague and arbitrary, you have to say that this definition here doesn't mean anything, doesn't have any concrete guidelines, and yet it has a lot of them. The person has to be a stranger. It has to be they promoted a relationship or this or that or the other thing. And certainly your client fits that definition.
Oh yes, this definition is amazing.
Other child molestation cases that wouldn't fit that definition.
This seems to include. When I was looking at it, it seems to include everybody except family members, friend of the family, and a babysitter. It's very expansive. The definition is very specific. It's when it's charged at the trial level. The prosecutor said it had only been charged once before, and I don't know if the prosecutor meant in King County or statewide. And the very rarity, given the lurid headlines that we're all familiar with, seems to me that it's the filing of the allegation that is arbitrary and ad hoc, and there are no standards to guide when they do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Amy Meckling appeared on behalf of the State of Washington. What I hear Mr. Phillips arguing is that the statute is unconstitutionally vague because the prosecutors can decide when to file it and when not to file it. But that's not the test for when a statute is vague. The existence of prosecutorial discretion to decide whether or not someone whose conduct clearly falls within the statute should be charged with it or not is not a vagueness issue at all. To be clear, a statute certainly needs to contain sufficient standards to prevent prosecutors from arbitrarily applying it to widely differing conduct that may or may not fit within inside the statute. And that means that if the statute is so unclear that it requires a totally subjective interpretation of whether someone's conduct fits or not, it could be vague. But this statute is very clear on which conduct fits within inside of it.
So if the prosecutors all get together at a state conference and say, you know, this predatory definition is pretty clear, but you know, we just don't think it's a good idea. We're going to back off on that. And one prosecutor statewide, though, says, no, I'm going to go the other direction. So does that portend to present a question of vagueness in
no.
the application?
It's not a vagueness it's not a vagueness issue. It may be an equal protection issue. I mean, certainly prosecutors have to exercise discretion. If a prosecutor just completely refuses to exercise their discretion and just charges something mandatorily in every single case, regardless of individual circumstances, or if the prosecutor files it for, you know, discriminatory or prohibited unconstitutional reasons, that's an equal protection argument. And I think that if the prosecutors got together and colluded in some fashion to either file it or not file it, there might be an argument there. That's not related to this
case. Has there ever been an argument there? I mean, in other words, are you able to cite a case where a conviction has been overturned because of an equal protection argument based on prosecutorial filing practices?
I recall there being a case where, and I don't remember the specifics, but where the prosecutor was either referring everybody automatically into drug court or not referring everybody automatically into drug court. And I don't, and obviously the charging decision can affect who goes into drug court and who doesn't. And I think that the court upheld that as proper. So I can't say that that's ever happened because, frankly, I don't think prosecutors do that. So I wouldn't be surprised if that had never happened.
There is a, I believe in the Sentencing Reform Act, there's a reference to, oh, sorry, I forgot to turn this on. So we'll I think you must have been up here for about 3 minutes.
Sounds right.
All right. Charging practices. And prosecutors' offices have charging practices,
yes.
Right? I mean, they're not binding. The court doesn't enforce them. But the prosecutor, in trying not to be arbitrary, will have standards that the people in that office are supposed to meet. And there's nothing wrong with that.
No, apparently. There's not. And, in fact,
but what is there something wrong with? That's what I'm trying to figure out, whether prosecutors have ever been not prosecutors, but whether a conviction has ever been reversed because of the way that because a prosecutor's charging practice violated the Equal Protection Clause.
Well, I don't know of any cases because that's not presented here, and that wasn't really the argument. So I didn't look into that. I imagine that maybe somewhere in the country there's been a situation where the defendant proved that he was charged for a discriminatory purpose, you know, because of his race or religion or something to that effect. That would certainly be improper. I don't know of anything off the top of my head. I mean, Mr. Phillips stands up here and says that this is vague because another defendant who was charged with molesting a child, did not get the predatory offense special allegation. How can the statute be vague? It sounds like the other defendant that she referred to, I don't recall the name, it sounds like his conduct may very well have fit within the predatory offense special allegation if he indeed committed first-degree child molestation of a stranger child. Whether the prosecutor chose to charge it in that case or not doesn't make it vague. There are many reasons why a prosecutor may choose or not choose to charge someone. That doesn't make that individual similarly situated to Mr. Phillips. Let's talk about what the record does not show in this case. The record does not show any similarly situated individuals to Mr. Phillips that he can complain were not charged with the allegation when he was. None. What would that person be? A person who committed first-degree rape of a child who, at the time of their crime, had pending federal child pornography charges, who within the previous year had been caught at two other thrift stores committing indecent exposure against children, and then within that same year went into a Goodwill in the middle of the day and dragged a 7-year-old into the bathroom and raped her in broad daylight.
That's Mr. Phillips.
That's Mr. Phillips. Yeah. And so he would have to show that there was someone else with the similarly situated, with those same set of circumstances that the state chose not to charge.
Wouldn't he have to show more than that? Because the statute also allows the prosecutor to take into account whether that allegation will impair proof of the case.
Absolutely.
So if you have better witnesses in one case than the other, you may choose to charge. If you don't have evidence of when the victim and the perpetrator first met each other, or what their relationship was, or it's ambiguous, you might choose not to charge. So simply showing the two people are similarly situated wouldn't be enough, would it?
Absolutely not. And I wasn't insinuating that that would be enough, but that's certainly one of the things he does have to show. It's not enough on its own, but he hasn't even made that bare showing. Your Honor
isn't
mentioned
the statute a lot. Isn't it almost identical to the sexual motivation statute that was at issue in State versus Holstein?
Yes.
Isn't State versus Holstein dispositive of this case?
As I indicated in my briefing, I believe that it is.
Yeah, because, I mean, the same thing happens there, right? You might have any number of people who are accused of burglary. Every once in a while, somebody's going to be accused of burglary with a sexual motivation. And why, you know, why is that not unfair? I mean, that would be the argument that is being made here on behalf of Phillips, is that it's unfair to single out some burglars.
Right. And I mean,
and there are others who might just as well have been charged with having a sexual motivation.
Right. And, you know, Mr. Phillips talks in his reply brief about how, well, the fact that this allegation has not been charged very often somehow demonstrates that prosecutors are exercising their discretion and, you know, have unfettered discretion or not exercising it properly in some fashion. I don't see that connection. It sounds to me like the fact that this charge is filed rarely indicates that prosecutors actually are judiciously using their discretion, because it's a significant sentence. It's a mandatory minimum of 25 years at least. It could be higher than that, depending on the standard range. So it sounds like Mr. Phillips, his conduct, there is no doubt, and I heard a concession today, that his conduct squarely fits within this statute. He's raised no equal protection claim in the sense that he's saying the prosecutor did not actually exercise its discretion in his case. And how could he? I mean, look at the facts of his background, in the crime itself. It's not surprising that the state charged him with this special allegation when it hasn't charged other people. This is an egregious crime committed by someone with a very recent and very significant history of abusing other children, or at least committing child-related offenses. Mr. Phillips, well, let's go back to what he was talking about with respect to the vagueness challenge, because I'm a little bit, I want to make sure that the court is not confused, because his argument was very confusing to me when I briefed it. Essentially, he's saying that because prosecutors have discretion to charge it, and they don't charge it very often, apparently, that somehow renders the statute vague. That's not the test for vagueness. The test for vagueness is whether or not ordinary people can understand what conduct fits within it, and whether there are sufficient standards so that prosecutors charge it appropriately, depending on...
Well, that's his argument. It's the second prong.
Right, and I think he's conflating the requirement that there be sufficient standards so that prosecutors know what conduct falls within the statute with the idea that there's this requirement that there be sufficient standards that tell prosecutors when they should or should not charge someone whose conduct clearly falls within the statute.
So is there a difference in the standards part of the test between when the charge is available to the prosecutor and when the discretion should be exercised?
There is a requirement that there be standards that define when the charge is available to the prosecutor. There is no such requirement that there be standards within the statute itself, at least in terms of the vagueness doctrine.
I asked counsel if the prosecutor had better discretion as long as it wasn't exercised for an illegal or unconstitutional reason. I think she agreed. It sounds like you do, too.
Yes. Yes. And then the Rice case that she cites, which is really one of the only cases that address the special allegation, has an entire page where they talk about the broad discretion of the prosecutor to charge it, and so long as it comports with equal protection, there's no problem. And we'd ask the court to reject Mr. Phillips' argument and affirm his sentence.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, the state talked about Mr. Phillips' history, and I would submit that that's taken care of in the standard range that he faces, and the fact that he has other pending charges. He hasn't been convicted of those at the time he was sentenced here. We did make an equal protection argument, and where that you have varying punishments for the same crime, the variation, the disparity must be based on rational distinctions between motives and methods of commission of the offense.
Do you have a factual record to support an equal protection argument?
In this case?
Yes.
By comparing it to these other cases that I was citing where conduct very similar, the person did not get the special allegation.
I mean, that doesn't seem like a very trustworthy sampling from any sort of a scientific perspective to determine how prosecutors are exercising their discretion.
I don't have access to how they, you know, how they work internally. What I did was I searched the crimes that are included in this predatory allegation to find factually similar.
There had been an appeal.
only appealed, and I was only able to find unpublished. I don't have trial court levels.
That's in the record, your list of unpublished opinions?
No, I just have it here. I can file that with the court.
No, I mean, that's a little bit late, I think, so.
I just brought those up for this argument this morning.
Your argument, I mean, your primary argument here seems to be the void for vagueness because of lack of standards. What case that is published, that is a void for vagueness case, do you think this is most like? What statute has been held unconstitutional for vagueness in the same way that you would like us to do with this one?
I can't answer that. I'll look into that. I'm sorry, I don't have an answer for that.
I mean, there are quite a few.
There are. I just can't answer that right off the top of my head. I'm sorry.
Isn't that kind of an indication that this isn't really a void for vagueness case?
I would disagree with that. I think this statute is void for vagueness. I think it violates equal protection, and it's unconstitutional.
Thank you.
Thank you.